Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Welcome to Podcast Like It's 1992, the podcast where we talk about the films of 1992 here from our perch in 2023. I am one of your hosts, Phyllis Gove.
And I am your special guest host, Emily St. James, sitting in this week for your normal host, who would not be on this podcast for because they were so offended, famed IRA member, Seamus O'Shaughnessy.
Yes.
TCI Bennigans. Yeah,
couldn't be on here. So Adam. Today we have Adam Beveri on from Variety.
Yes.
What's your title? Forgive me. What is your title?
Senior entertainment writer.
Perfect. So you came on the 2009 Patreon for A Single Man.
Yes.
And then you also came on for Being John Malkovich with your friend Mike Harris to talk about Being John Malkovich. And so I reached out to you early on and I was like, we're doing 92. Emily and I are doing 92. What are your movies? And you gave me a whole list of them. I put your name next to a bunch of them. Patriot Games was one of them.
Yes.
And I'll be honest, I was a little surprised. I don't say that with judgment at all. We'll obviously unpack this, but I'm curious why Patriot Games, Adam?
Well, first, I just have to say I'm very flattered that you've had me back on, and I'm frankly relieved that your co-host will probably not stumble into accidental homophobia the way that co-host.
It's true. It was unintentional, but yes, he did step in
twice. He did it twice.
It's true. Emily, I don't think we'll suffer the same fate.
Probably not.
Yeah.
We'll see. First of all, I was thinking about like 1992 as a moment, as like its own filmmaking moment, and one very different from 1999.
Oh, yeah.
And trying to think of like what movies to me really represent 1992 as both sort of the era of filmmaking and also like movies that just are not made anymore. And this is really on the top of that list. I mean, I rewatched it last night and I was reminded anew of like, oh, there are scenes where there are literally hundreds of people milling about all throughout this. And even before the pandemic, nobody was spending that much money on extras, let alone all of these different location shootings, hiring helicopters that are real helicopters, and like just all kinds of things that are done to tell this story. Like the, all the shot, the whole sequence on the highway just would not be done the same way. Like
the speedboat chase at the end. I was just like, this shit's practical.
Yeah, exactly. And then, so there's that element of it.
Yeah.
And then it is, I just think, a deeply satisfying, perfect little Swiss watch of a movie. I think it knows exactly what kind of movie it is, and it accomplishes that pretty much exactly how it wants. It like it knows exactly what it's going to deliver, and it delivers it exactly right. Mm-hmm. And it sort of almost proves the point of Harrison Ford's stardom as an action star, mm-hmm. which in the 80s, other than Indiana Jones, was still sort of like in quite like, can he be like he was True. Making all these dramas
yep.
separate from Indiana Jones, but he was not really hitting as an action star in the same way. And then here comes this movie and sort of reinforces that idea. I mean, there's also I'm sure we'll get into it that like yes. all the machinations about how this movie was
oh
made.
Oh my god, it's Tom Clancy
like sabotaging it. But I just think that like as a sort of representation of Harrison Ford's strengths mm-hmm. as a movie star
mm-hmm.
On every level, on the like the dreamy, I just want to look at this man for 2 hours level, on the sort of like the representation of a kind of masculinity that he's so good at evincing, of like strength, but like wounded strength
yep.
and like, you know, his impotent rage is like no one does it better than him.
So what I wanted to sort of unpack here with this film, as we sort of start off, I'm like, so I saw this film in the theater. I was 12 when this movie came wow. out, and I remember seeing it in the theater because my mom always liked Harrison Ford. I mean, who didn't like Harrison Ford? And there was sort of this like, oh, it's his new franchisey thing, and he's, you know, fighting bad guys and whatever. And I assume that she didn't think there was anything that I couldn't see. And quite frankly, there really wasn't. Like it's, if anything, it's kind of, it's a pretty lo-fi action movie. Do you know what I mean? Like,
yes.
which also speaks to that sort of this period we're in 92, where effects aren't 100%, like CG effects aren't 100% there, and they obviously will become the main attraction literally next year with Jurassic yeah. Park, and that'll all change. But so there, I tried to put myself back into my 12-year-old body sitting in the theater, and I was just like, I must have been bored by this movie at 12. Do you know what I mean? Like, this is a pretty talky techno-political thriller about the IRA, and something I imagine I knew nothing about at 12. So like, I yeah. just didn't really even understand the conflicts that were probably the sort of, you know, so it is interesting. And this kind of comes to my bigger question. And we sort of, we tapped into this a little bit, Emily, at the end of our Candyman episode that preceded this with Roxana, but because obviously those two go hand in hand. The Tom Clancy of it all. I would love to hear, Adam, your feelings on the Tom Clancy verse and how we are.
I looked this up online. It's called the Ryan verse.
Oops, my apologies. Egg all over my face.
I've never read a single Tom Clancy book.
Sure.
I think intuit it was not going to be my vibe. My yes. dad had read them, I don't think it was going to be for me. Mm-hmm. I like all three of these like 90s Jack Ryan movies.
So Hunt for Red October,
Patriot
Games, Clear and Present Danger.
Clear and Present Danger is where you start to see,
yeah,
like it. It's sort of working what it wants to be and what it actually is are kind of at cross purposes.
Yeah.
But I think they, for one thing, they are enormously topical. They are sort of representations of a very moment in politics, global politics, that, again, you just don't get now. No one makes movies about global politics today, at least at this scale. And that is all Clancy. But yeah. What's interesting is that when Clancy, who is, you know, a
titan of industry at this time.
Yeah, well, yeah. He's right wing. Like, people were saying that, like, yeah. from the get-go. When it gets filtered through the sort of Hollywoodization, it's a sort of interesting amalgamation of two different very sensibilities that, for the first two movies especially, I think work really well. The attempts to reboot Jack Ryan in this century have never quite worked for me. I've seen all three. I saw the Ben Affleck movie,
some of all
I saw fears. the Chris Pine movie, and I've watched some of the Amazon series with John Krasinski. Thank you. Mm-hmm. None of them really work. They don't. They are either too much like this is for red state dads, like the Amazon show very much, or they just are like, they don't, they want to be just a generic action spy movie. They don't want to be a Jack Ryan situation.
Yeah.
Like that, the politics of Clear and Present Danger, the movie, and of whatever that, well, I don't even remember the name of the.
Some of All Fears?
Some of All Fears.
Yeah.
Sorry. Some of All Fears is Ben Affleck. But what's the name of the.
Recruit. Something Recruit. Jack Ryan, like fucking.
Shadow Recruit.
Shadow Recruit.
I was going to say Ghost Recruit. I was like, I was so close.
So close. They don't make any sense. Either they don't fit into the current political, geopolitical moment
in
any meaningful way. And so they don't really feel like Jack Ryan movies. So
and they also got Without Remorse, we should just say, which was the Amazon Michael B. Jordan thing, which came out during the pandemic. Yeah. Which was,
but that's like not Jack Ryan, right?
It's not
like
Jack
a different.
Ryan.
It's different...
Jack Ryan adjacent, though. He knows Jack Ryan. The character he plays knows Jack Ryan.
Oh, okay. So it's the same Tortellis
yes!
to Jack Ryan's Cheers.
Exactly.
Okay, cool.
Exactly.
Great. No, I like what I like about Tom Clancy. Mm. Like, is that his name? I've never read a book by him. I don't know if I like. But what I like about Tom Clancy's a brand name is that he's so associated with 80s and 90s geopolitics, and specifically like late Cold War. Once you got past the collapse of the Soviet Union, he kind of like was lost without a gear to shift to. Now his name is just sort of slapped on video games. Yep. And they're all about like post-apocalyptic scenarios, but they're like presented with like this veneer of like, well, of course, this is what happens when this fictional country collapses and causes a domino effect in the Middle East. And then all of the countries turn on each other and there's a nuclear war. Anyway, now you have to go kill a bunch of civilians somewhere. And it's just like,
you've played the games. Am I correct?
I have played some of the games. Okay. There's a really, God, what's the one that I loved so much? I played so much of it.
Isn't there a Ghost Legion or something like that?
I mean, there's so many of them. There's something called The Division, which people got very upset about. There's this game, Shadow something.
Yes.
I don't know.
Fuck. Yeah, hold on.
Skulking around and it's a really fun game. It's Tom Clancy's something. Ghost Recon, maybe?
Yes, Ghost Recon. That is exactly what it is.
I really love that game. That's my contribution.
My question to both of you, as I watched this film and did, you know, a cursory amount of research on the character of Jack Ryan, and the thing that kind of made my head hurt is that, like, he's an analyst. He's a pencil pusher. He's not even supposed to be in the field. And yet we've turned this, quite frankly, like kind of nerdy guy with a lanyard into an action hero. And it does feel a little bit like a round peg in a square hole a little bit. You know what I mean?
But isn't that just Indiana Jones? Isn't that just Indiana Jones? Like, I'm also thinking about like Robert Langdon from Dan Brown.
Indiana Jones is like the inverse of what Jack Ryan is. Indiana Jones is a guy who's built for adventure, who tries to make himself into a professor, but he's always drawn back into the field. Where it feels like I feel like Hunt for Red October and Patriot Games do a really good job of making Jack feel like he is just a sort of nerdy dude who finds himself forced into action-based situations. I think I looked up the way that the book ends in Patriot Games, and it's very different.
Very different, yeah.
And much more, I think, true to the idea of him being an analyst who's not really a field guy. Whereas the idea that the way that Patriot Games ends in the movie is much more like he is like a full-blown action hero, and he needs an action hero ending. And it is this thing that happens with especially book adaptations, where the need for it to be a very specific kind of entertainment supersedes all other considerations. Yeah. And so like this idea that the audience is just not going to feel satisfied unless there's a visceral, exciting, action-based confrontation between our hero and our villain, where the villain clearly and definitively dies, is every studio exec is like, you obviously are doing this right. In the book, that doesn't happen. I don't think he even dies. Sean Miller, I don't think dies. He gets captured.
Well, I tried to read Tom Clancy a couple times when I was a kid
for this podcast.
This is now
Phil and Emily's Tom Clancy. This is Clancy Cast.
You knew that we were going to be doing this podcast as a kid, and you tried.
Yes, and I was like, I want to read a 1,200-page tome that talks about loading a gun over and over and over again, and the various types of bullets and what magazines look like. And I mean, it is. I understand who those books are for, right? They're for right-leaning dads that want to read all sorts of techno babble about like boats and guns and planes and shit like that. Like
militarized. And my wife,
and
when she was 13.
Apologies, and Libby as well. So I remember, because I do think as a kid in the sort of early to mid 90s, there were sort of two authors that wrote books of that length: Tom Clancy and Stephen King.
And
neither of which had an editor, apparently, and their books were just doorstops. And I remember I bought, it might have been Without Remorse for all I know, I don't really remember, but I remember I bought one of the Tom Clancy books as a kid, and I can't imagine I got more than 100 pages into it, because I was so dulled by the attention to detail, because it just was not a world that I was particularly interested in. I bring all this up just to say that, like, there is sort of this like high techness that exists within the Clancy books that isn't necessarily transferred particularly well in the early 90s, because I almost feel like movie tech isn't there yet. Like, I feel almost as though Some of All Fears might not be a good movie, but like the casting of Ben Affleck makes more sense. His youth makes sense. It doesn't, you know what I mean? Harrison Ford being in his 50s as an analyst, and sort of the level that he's at is a little weird. I mean, Alec Baldwin was, we'll get into that whole thing. But this is all just to say that, like, in the early 2000s, it felt like movie technology and Tom Clancy technology finally kind of coalesced into something that made sense. They just were never able to actually capitalize on it, if that makes sense.
I see that. I do remember... I don't know if I saw the movie in Patriot Games in the theater, but I do remember when it came out, there was a lot of talk about the satellite-based raid sequence, because it was, I think, for a lot of people, the first time they were ever made wise to the fact that that is something
a thing,
like that's a thing that you could do. And you know, certainly I got a really good chuckle out of the can you enhance it please and it's like, that's not how that works, but it was sort of interesting how quaint it feels now. At the same time, the morality of that sequence still really is very clear, and I think as resonant to me today as it was, and perhaps even more with drone warfare being the way that we do everything, then
well, and I would also
even in 92. Yeah.
I would also say too, I 100% agree with you. I feel like there's two things that stayed with me as a kid, that all the night vision stuff at the end, like all that stuff really stayed with
people,
me.
People fucking into night vision at this point in time. Like people, I was going to say, maybe this is like a response to Silence of the Lambs, maybe, but like Silence of the Lambs is maybe too close to it, but also like, people just were like, you can see things at night now.
I mean, there was that, but then I think, you know, to piggyback on what you're saying, Adam, I couldn't help this time watching that footage and thinking of Zero Dark Thirty and thinking about that sort of stuff and how I imagine watching this in 92, not to mention the fact that, like, you know, you got the Iraq War, you got all that sort of stuff that's all kind of still in the ether. So all of that must have been very potent, I imagine, to audiences at the time as well.
Absolutely. I think Zero Dark Thirty is in some ways the movie that feels closest to a Tom Clancy, Jack Ryan movie of the last 20 years, even including the Jack Ryan movies to me.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I'm going to leave a little bit of context for our listeners that might not have seen Patriot Games. When former CIA agent Jack Ryan, played by Harrison Ford, hampers an IRA terrorist attack in London, he kills one of the terrorists. The dead man's brother, another member of the group named Sean Miller, played by Sean Bean, is arrested but quickly escapes. Vowing revenge against Ryan, Miller travels to the United States where he forces Ryan's wife, played by Ann Archer, and daughter, played by Thora Birch, into a car accident that badly injures them. This convinces Ryan to rejoin the CIA in order to track down Miller. Patriot Games opened on June 5th, 1992 against Sister Act, Lethal Weapon 3, Far and Away, and Scene Man and the Mighty Ducks.
Holy shit.
Different just, time.
What an interesting array of movies happening in theaters at the exact same time.
It would go on to make $178 million on a $45 million budget. It's got 74% on Rotten Tomatoes from critics, 72% from audiences. Roger Ebert gave the film 2.5 stars and said, you don't expect a Tom Clancy movie to end with people tracking each other around a darkened house followed by a gun battle involving two speedboats, one of them on fire on a dark and stormy night. I haven't read Clancy's Patriot Games, and for all I know, this movie is faithful to that book. But on the basis of The Hunt for Red October, which I have read, I expected this one to be a little more cerebral and without the Indiana Jones end. Patriot Games has at least some virtues in the season of soft porn masquerading as hard thrillers, of being about subjects more interesting than the character's sex lives. The high-tech stuff is absorbing. Harrison Ford once again demonstrates what a solid, convincing actor he is, and there's a good supporting cast from Archer, Thora Birch, and the Ryan's precocious daughter, and the irreplaceable James Fox as a British cabinet member. But at the end, when a character is leaping into a burning speedboat in choppy seas, I was wondering if this is exactly what Tom Clancy had in mind. What do you think about that, Emily? Yeah.
Just take a moment to say, Roger Ebert praising Harrison Ford as an actor there. I think Harrison Ford, underrated actor. We're recording this a few days after the Oscars. I really just want to call him out. He perfect delivery of everything, everywhere, exact right pause. Everybody's cheering all at once. Yes, absolutely.
Nailed it.
I was like, I'm in, Harrison. Thank you. I'm here to collect my Oscar.
So I want to unpack Harrison Ford for a second here, because the irony is that we only talked about Harrison Ford once on that. I apologize. That's wrong. Twice. We talked about him for Indiana Jones, The Last Crusade on our 89 Patreon. And we talked about him on a Random Hearts episode, a movie that no one should ever have to watch, which came out in 1999. Harrison Ford obviously has a fascinating career, and I think this movie hits at a fascinating time for him because, as you mentioned up top, you know, 80s action hero Blade Runner, Return of the Jedi, Temple of Doom. But then, you know, he does Witness, he does Mosquito Coast, Frantic, those three movies in a row as sort of a way of saying, like, I'm not just an action hero. But none of those movies, Witness was a bit of a hit, but Frantic and Mosquito Coast, not so much. He does Working Girl as well in 88. Then he's got Last Crusade in 89, Presumed Innocent in 90 regarding Henry, Patriot Games. And then right after this, you've got The Fugitive. I feel like this movie and The Fugitive definitely speak to each other. Like, there is a everyman quality to him in Patriot Games that I really felt. The way he fights, he feels like he's older. He feels like a real guy who's sort of, you know, on the other side of 50. And The Fugitive, I think, doubles down on that and is straight up masterpiece because it really understands how to weaponize that. But this movie is definitely toying with those things too.
I think so too. I think that it's interesting that he chose to do this movie because Presumed Innocent and Regarding Henry were both successes. They performed well. So it wasn't like he was at that point hurting to be a bigger star. But I read a quote with him where he's apparently said at the time something like, I had been a guy in an office for a lot, and I feel like I had to punch somebody in my next movie. And it's like, like from a commercial standpoint, there's no need from a like star maintenance standpoint, I can sort of see his point. And he seems to be, people seem to like him the most when he's sort of vaguely angry and is like trying to make something happen.
Get off my plane.
And what I said earlier is very true. I think that this movie makes incredible use of his best qualities as a star. So I think that what's interesting to me also is that there's a thing that happens in Clear and Present Danger where he sort of represents like good upstanding moralism in a totally corrupted government. And that's what I meant by the movie seems to be sort of cross purposes with each other. In this, he is like the government is as effective and as functional as he is. And so he doesn't have to carry the burden of being our representation of what we want a man in that position to be. He can just be the guy in the situation. Yeah. And I think that wears on him so much better when he has to be sort of a symbol. Even I like Air Force One. I feel like that movie is often operates in quotation marks.
Yes. It's a silly movie.
It's a little silly. And
what? No. I thought it was a documentary.
Yeah. Glenn Close, VP of this exactly. country.
Yeah. Like in Patriot Games, it is an enormously heightened situation that the book is even more heightened for. And I actually want to get into the Royals aspect of it. In a bit, because I have a rant that I've been saving up. But I think one of the reasons why I think this movie is so effective is that he's just the guy. He's not a symbol. Even though he's being used as a movie star, he's allowed to play the situation instead of being a symbol.
So Emily, what are your thoughts on your husband Harrison Ford and his career around this time or in general?
I hate that this podcast is now Emily is horny for men of the 90s, but I am, is the thing. No, I love Harrison Ford, a lot of these like titans of 80s, 90s movies, because I didn't get to watch a lot of movies growing up. I don't have the emotional attachment to them that people do, but I got to see all the Indiana Jones movies. I got to see a number of his famous 90s movies. Fugitive was very formative for me, as was Air Force One, a perfect movie that there's nothing wrong with. But there's something about him that is like simultaneously deeply committed to everything he's doing, and you buy him intensely.
Sure.
But also you can see like he's got like just a 1% of him is wondering what's at craft services in every movie. It's amazing, and he's great, and it's just like I think that's key to his appeal. There's like some actors who they're just dialed in, and that's why you love them. Harrison Ford kind of feels like, what if you were a middle-aged dad and somebody was like, hey, you're a movie star now, and you're like, cool, and like that you didn't really have to modulate yourself, you just totally showed up, you just like, but then he's got the charisma that carries him through. It's just he's such a compelling guy. And we were talking earlier about Jack Ryan just being a nerdy analyst. And listen, if I lived in the DC area and I was on like Tinder and I met like a 50 something single dad nerdy analyst who looked like Harrison Ford, and he was just like, yeah, you know, I work for the CIA. I have my one vice. If we're dating, I have my Settlers of Catan night every Thursday. That's important to me. I would like to give him my number instantly. Yeah. I don't know how Tinder works. I'm married. I'm just assuming.
Emily, Emily, that is one of the best Harrison Ford impressions I've ever heard.
One of the fun things about doing voice training as a trans woman is that you get impressions of a bunch of random male actors. I had a really great Brian Cox for a while, and then I lost it. But evidently, I have a good Harrison Ford. So
the Harrison Ford thing, I think, is interesting to me, just in the sense that I think if you asked him, do you care about any of your roles? Like, do they mean anything to you? I think the only one he cares about is Indiana Jones. I think it's the only one that he actually gives a shit about.
Everyone that I've ever talked to who's interviewed him, and this is evident in every interview he's basically ever gave, is that he sees himself very much as a blue collar worker. You know, he's there to do a craft. He's a little bit like, you know, a carpenter in that he was a carpenter. He's there to service the script. He's there to, you know, service the audience. And he sees himself as a sort of in the service industry. So he's not, it's not like he's doesn't think that he makes art or anything, but right. I don't think I would say that if I would be surprised if there were a lot of quotes of him talking about being an artist. I think that he sees himself as a guy who's there to do a job. And you know, he cares about Indiana Jones. He didn't care about Han Solo until he cared about Han Solo. And
to care about Han
Solo. Exactly. But I think that by and large, going to what Emily was saying about this sort of 1% of him thinking about craft services, he's not, and this is also part of his appeal, I think he's not sort of wound up his own ass about his ability to act. And so it makes him so much more grounded and relatable in that way, because you're not ever thinking about how impressed he is with the fact that he's like doing an incredible job at the scene. He's just very present.
I think there was a time when, and I don't necessarily know that he was ever chasing an Oscar, because I don't know that that's necessarily something he cares about. But I do think that that period that I mentioned earlier of sort of Frantic and Mosquito Coast and Witness and like trying to show his bona fides a little bit more as a, you know what I mean? And then I think something sort of happened. I mean, obviously I don't know this for a fact, but if you look at his filmography, you know, there's kind of a moment when it's like, you know, he's taking paychecks and he's making Firewall and Hollywood Homicide and he's just like, you know, whatever. And I do feel like, and I don't know, I'm sure you guys know this, but I'll say it again. He was offered the Michael Douglas role in Traffic. You know, he had thoughts on the script and some changes he wanted to make to it and this, that, and whatever. And ultimately, they didn't all kind of get on the same page and he dropped out of the project. And I kind of feel like that could have been the key to a interesting third act in Harrison Ford's career. And I think that, you know, I don't know what the reasons were. I'm sure it wasn't political. I'm sure that there was any number of things that he just, you know, either didn't feel comfortable talking about or didn't know if the movie was going to work or who knows what. But, you know, that moment in, you know, I guess it would probably fall somewhere between 99 and 2000 where that movie happens and he's not there. You kind of wonder whether or not that was kind of the moment.
I do wonder, you know, in that there's that moment in Traffic where Michael Douglas goes into the sort of the bowels of the city to find his daughter. Yep. And if that had been Harrison Ford, it would have just those scenes would have felt different.
Yep.
You would not have felt as desperate and you would not have been as worried about whether that guy was going to get out of there alive.
Correct. Correct.
And I think that and one of the other things that Harrison Ford is sort of almost contradictorily very good at is being aware of his own stardom and what he's bringing to the performance, and not just as an actor, but as a presence. And so I do wonder if that might have been part of it. I don't know, but that's
it's a little bit of a sliding door moment for him. But sorry, Emily. Yeah.
No. I was thinking about there are two times in my life where it has felt like Hollywood was ready to give Harrison Ford an Oscar. And the first is Morning Glory, where it really felt like when that movie was coming up, the hype around it was like, Harrison Ford is going to do comedy again. He hasn't really done it since Working Girl. Yep. In this sort of zone. Mm-hmm. He's going to waltz away with the supporting actor Oscar. Doesn't happen. When Blade Runner 2049 came out, and like that got the reviews. He's amazing in that movie. If that movie had been a hit, and if he had like done the bare minimum of going on the campaign circuit, he absolutely would have won the Oscar for that movie. Like
I totally agree with you. And he showed the fuck up for that movie too. I mean, he really acted as.
I also think that when he played Branch Rickey in 42.
Oh, right. Mm-hmm.
That was such an un-Harrison Ford performance. He actually did a thing.
He did a thing.
He did a thing. And he did it effectively. He like was committed to it. It wasn't like, it was like, I don't know about this thing. It was like, I was into the thing. I think that if he had campaigned, he might have gotten the support. I mean, I think that movie also just in general was not well served by the awards.
It was a little bit of a middle of the road movie too. Like it wasn't, you know what I mean? It had some special qualities to it. I don't mean to suggest that it was, you know, a B. It was like a B plus, maybe an A minus.
I think like lots of actors have gotten supporting acting nominations.
Oh, for sure, for
B minuses and C pluses. Yeah, absolutely. But I see what you're saying.
I wouldn't say it's a B plus, but it's a B, and then you've made the up and down line to start making the plus. That's where that movie falls. I have this weird counterfactual where. Mm-hmm. I don't know if this is true, but I've heard this rumor a number of times that like he was one of the people they had in mind for John Ford in The Fablemans. And I think they cast the right person for that role. But I think if Harrison Ford is in that role, I think he does get an Oscar nomination. And then we get a whole season of people being like Harrison Ford and Kehi Kwan. They're in the same category. It would have been so annoying.
This alternate universe is interesting. I don't know that like, I mean, the reality is that David Lynch is fantastic in it, but you also never forget that it's David Lynch. So I guess ultimately, you know what I mean? It's like, whatever. You wouldn't forget
I think that what happens there is you get the cuteness of it being Spielberg ending this movie about himself with Harrison Ford, you know? And like, I think it, to some degree it's just fan casting, but also, I don't know. I think it would have been fun. I think it would have been great. And then we would have had a whole month of you know, just every publication being like, there's these two people. Oh, I'm sorry, a whole 6 months of publication being like, and like a me writing a thing where the headline's like, can you believe these two have met again?
I do think it is interesting that, I mean, the Morning Glory thing is interesting because I remember there was a lot of hype around that movie. And this is also kind of funny because earlier today I recorded an episode on Game Night. We were talking about Rachel McAdams and Morning Glory and all of that. But I do think that had Morning Glory been closer to a James L. Brooks movie, right? And been like a little bit more substantive and a little less kind of frothy. Even quite frankly, and I don't mean an even to qualify, but like Nancy Myers or something along those lines, I think that there's a good chance he probably could have got a nomination from it. But I think ultimately it's just a little bit too disposable. It's a little too cute. It's a little too rom-com-y for its own good. And ultimately that sort of holds it back. But I mean, he's a fascinating, I mean, I'm just looking here at like Cowboys and Aliens and, you know, Age of Adeline. And it's just like, just lots. He works, the guy works, but I just don't know that he actually cares that much.
I think my point is if Harrison Ford wanted an Oscar, he could win one in 5 seconds by just like going a movie by like a PTA or someone who's like at that level of auteur, taking a small part, putting in his level best, submitting himself to whatever the process is, and then just going to like 5 events across award season, he would just mop the floor with everyone. Yeah. People want to give this man an Oscar in a way they didn't want to give Stallone an Oscar, and he doesn't want to do it.
That's true. That's true.
You know, I'm looking at his filmography.
Mm-hmm.
And from 2002 to 2008, so over 6 years, he made only four movies. K-19 The Widowmaker, Hollywood Homicide, yikes. Firewall, yikes. Yikes. And Indiana Jones and the Kingdom of Crystal Skull, yikes.
Yikes.
That is absolutely a B, and then you've made the line for a plus movie. I kind of love that movie.
Crystal Skull? All right.
Yeah.
In the same, from 2017 to 2024, he made 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 movies.
Yeah.
Blade Runner 2049, Secret Life of Pets 2. Love that. That his one scene in Star Wars: The Rise of Skywalker, yikes! But
where he rolls out of bed unshaven and says like 10 lines of dialogue.
The Call of the Wild, that movie that I think would have been more of a thing if there hadn't been a pandemic.
Would it with that CG dog? That dog looked so computer generated. Anyway, yeah, that's true.
Indiana Jones and the Dial of Destiny, which we'll see, and then. It may be six. It may not be seven. He's definitely in Captain America and the New World Order, which is also just blows my mind that he's about to join the Marvel Cinematic Universe. He's going to start shooting it in like a month. And then
Thunderbolts.
People think he's going to be in Thunderbolts, but Marvel will not actually commit to confirming that.
I mean, listen, I love Harrison Ford. He's so immensely watchable. There is something so, and I do think it's what you're both saying about how he feels just checked out enough that it allows you in a little bit, like you're able to sort of see the strings just a little, and it keeps it all kind of feeling not silly. I don't know how to describe, like watching this movie, watching Patriot Games and seeing like the fight he has with the guy in the Andover, I think sweatshirt who tries to kill him, who's like 30 years younger than him. Right. And you're never for a second really believe that Harrison Ford could beat up this guy, but like, there's this tussle and you just, the way he throws a punch like no one else. He throws a punch with like his entire body. There's just something so lovable about him. I don't know what else to say. He feels like a real guy. He feels like your dad. I don't know. It is a special thing. And you know, I don't know. I like him in romantic movies. I think he's great in Working Girl. I think he's, you know, I even think he's pretty good in the Sabrina remake. You know, no. I wish you guys could have seen Adam's face. He did not agree with the Sabrina thoughts.
I agree with Adam in this case. Yeah.
You don't buy him as a bogey type?
No.
What I do buy him as is Shia LaBeouf's father. Like, that's a thing that's important to me to understand. No.
Sure. So this movie, Adam, you sort of hinted at this, but I want to kind of talk a little bit about the legal scuffle that this film sort of had in its way to the screen. It seemed as though there was sort of this moment when ABC wanted to make a TV movie of it in 87. And then Paramount claimed that because of their adaptation of Hunt for Red October, that they owned the rights to the Jack Ryan character. It was just all this like weird sort of machinations going on behind the screen. And then on top of all of this, it seemed as though, I mean, if you listen to Alec Baldwin and maybe don't, I don't know, Alec Baldwin, there's a lot of questions to be asked, but Alec Baldwin hints at the fact that they wanted him out of the role because Harrison had started to sort of suss it out and seemed as though he was interested in it. So there was this whole like Alec Baldwin was he was contracted to play a role in Streetcar Named Desire on Broadway, so they pushed up the production of Patriot Games so that he couldn't be in the role, and all sorts of, I don't know, Hollywood.
I don't think that Paramount wanted him to play Jack Ryan anymore. I think that they Alec Baldwin sort of basically claimed that there was this movie that was supposed to happen that Harrison Ford was going to do for Paramount that fell through because of the economy tanking in 90. Okay. And Alec Baldwin claimed, not naming Harrison Ford by name, but all but saying that because of that, Paramount wanted to make good with Harrison Ford, who was a much, much, much bigger star than Alec Baldwin at the time and to this day. And so, you know, that won the day. And I just think that Paramount was like, looked at, we could have Harrison Ford or we could have Alec Baldwin. Let's go with Harrison Ford. And I think that this movie would just feel differently if it was Alec Baldwin. I don't know if it would be better or worse. I'm not sure. I think that you know, I would be kind of interested to sort of play that thought experiment out a little bit. It would be hilarious to me if Gates McFadden got to continue playing Kathy Ryan as a Brit in Hunt for October. She's playing her British. And so I think she would have to, I guess, maintain that. It's just sort of like also an interesting sort of what if for that actor's career.
Yeah. Paramount clearly, you know, pays a lot of money for a 3-picture deal for Harrison Ford to play Jack Ryan. 2 movies are only made with him. So they don't actually fulfill the third film in the contract. Hard to say why. Clear and Present Danger did quite
well. I don't know if you read this, but there's an Entertainment Weekly story that's fascinating on a lot of levels, on a journalism level,
sure,
as much as anything, that came out when Clear and Present Danger was released that got really granular into a lot of the sort of Harrison Ford style parts of it.
Sure.
That said that Ford was only signing deals to make one of these movies at a time, which contradicts the reports that he had signed this 3-picture deal. So I don't know where the sort of how you square that circle, but it's interesting. Like,
no, that is really interesting.
Yeah. How that all sort of fell together. Yeah.
It's also like Hunt for Red October, huge hit. Mm-hmm. This is a big hit. Clear and Present Danger, also a hit, but they're tailing off. Like, they're making a little less money with everything.
No, they're not.
Really?
Globally, Clear and Present Danger made the most.
Okay. I thought I'd looked that up and found,
which is ironic since Clear and Present Danger is the most sort of North America centric. Like, it's not even particularly international, right? Isn't that all about the drug trade in Mexico?
In Mexico and I think in Colombia.
Clear and Present Danger got like weirdly good reviews. It got some Oscar nominations.
It did.
It's like I don't know. I think it is also that Tom Clancy was a huge pain in the ass to work with. He just complained about everything.
Yeah.
And I also think the frisson you get that we've sort of talked about, which is Tom Clancy writing these right-ish novels, but like Hollywood being able to adapt them in a way where they could basically say, well, you know, global geopolitics is complicated. And then your dad would nod solemnly and say, yes, it is. Like, that was a thing that you could do at this point in time that very quickly you stop being able to do. Mm-hmm. And like, when you're trying to adapt Clancy's Cold War books for the post Cold War era, like you get into a space where you're working with an author who doesn't want any changes made to his books, but you have to make changes to make them make sense for the present day. I think to my brain, it sort of makes sense why they stopped and why they tried the hard reboot, you know, in 2002.
Yeah. I mean, I think it is interesting, first of all, that again, from what I read, and I completely believe what you were saying, Adam, from this EW article, but it says that Ford signed a $9 million 3-picture contract. That's pretty low. $9 million for 3 pictures seems pretty low to me. But again, it's 92, so that's probably
money. Yeah.
Probably, but 20 now.
Yeah. I mean, this story was written by the late Bruce Fretz. And it is like, talk about things that don't happen anymore. The amount of access that he got and the amount of like how just like no bullshit unvarnished quotes he got from everybody about what a pain in the ass Clear and Present Danger was to make. It's astonishing to read. It's all on the EW site, which is also rare because as a former Entertainment Weekly writer myself, a lot of the stuff I wrote there does not exist in any form online anymore. That's not the rant, by the way, that I wanted to go on. But what became very clear reading that story was it, like, Tom Clancy was an all-time nightmare, and there's no way forward because they didn't have the rights to any of his other books. So they had to renegotiate with him before they were going to get anything else. So that was hurdle number one. Hurdle number two was his other books. None of them were as quite like the Sum of All Fears was that sort of next logical one. And they, you know, they blow up the Super Bowl, which had apparently just happened in a different movie. And so, you know, it's, I think it's, even if there was like a ready-made book to go through, and even if Paramount had somehow magically negotiated to get Tom Clancy on board, it also reads very clear that like Harrison was like, I'm good.
Yeah, I'm done. Yeah.
I don't need to do it, this anymore. This is too
much. It's, I mean, when you look at where sort of Clear and Present Danger is 94, which is, I mean, 2 years later, he literally Patriot Games 92, Fugitive 93, Clear and Present Danger 94, Sabrina 95. I mean, this guy is like got a movie out basically every year for the better part of a decade. It's pretty crazy, over a decade. It is pretty insane. And I'm sure he was just fucking tired and was like, I don't need this in my life. The Tom Clancy thing is interesting too, because as I'm sure you guys read, he made such a stink about Patriot Games. He was very loud and vocal about his thoughts about it. And then they showed him a cut. So apparently, like, Brendan Tartikoff, ironically, who is running Paramount at the time, met Clancy to show him a rough cut of the film, assuaged concerns enough to guarantee that he would work with the studio again. Like, at this point, Tom Clancy was ready to just like burn this bridge, which is pretty insane. But apparently he said something along the lines of, during production, he asked his name to be taken off the film. He complained that the final attack scene was unrealistic, that he had not been shown any rushes, and he said he was not sure that a movie would get made of Clear and Present Danger because, quote unquote, I think Patriot Games will turn out so bad.
This is a total tangent, but I'm interested. Are there authors who command this level of respect within Hollywood these days? Like, I mean, J.K. Rowling burned herself in effigy, but like she was kind of the last one. Yeah,
she's burned herself in effigy, but she still commands. Like, they're still going to want to make more of the Harry Potter. Like, you know, I cannot believe it, but she still commands a great deal of power over there.
Sure. Yeah. And it's, and yet, like, the thing is, they sort of have to do everything they can to pretend that Harry Potter doesn't emerge from her, even though they're like putting her name in credits and everything.
Yeah.
Which is like, obviously its own situation, but yeah, she's kind of the last one. Like, you look at kind of the big mega selling author right now is Colleen Hoover, and she writes romance, and romance is Hollywood has a weird checkered history with that anyway. But like, you can't imagine her getting into a similar situation as Tom Clancy, John Grisham, Stephen King, Michael Crichton, sort of those four titans of the 80s and 90s.
Well, you know, it's interesting you bring that up, because what this made me think of in terms of how outspoken Tom Clancy was at the time was the big stink that Anne Rice made about Interview with the Vampire when it was in production, right? That, you know, that movie was 94. She was very vocal about how she did not think Tom
Cruise put on an ad.
That. She but put out a full page ad, and then she put out another full page ad afterwards. Yeah. But she puts out a full page ad basically being like, this is terrible. It should not be Tom Cruise. What the fuck is going on? But I don't have the, obviously she didn't have legal ramifications, so she just made it a PR stint essentially, and then ultimately eats her words and says he's great, and you know, the movie's obviously a big hit, and he is great in the film. But that's the only person that I can think of that actually really tried. This is also obviously pre-internet, right? So it's like there really is no way to kind of corral your fans in the
way. I think that there's this is too much of a tangent, I think, to dive down too much into, but I do wonder if there's a sort of micro niche version of this now where like a lot of authors have cultivated really dedicated but very narrow casted readerships, and I think that if there were any adaptations of those books that the author wasn't happy with, and if that author raised a stink about it,
I agree with that,
that those like rabidly on very online fandoms could then make a could make problems. But at the scale of a Tom Clancy, no. I think that Rowling is the last, for sure.
Yeah, I feel like, you know, the person that comes to mind is someone you guys might not even... Leah Bardugo, who does the Shadow and Bone books, has obviously a very, you know, dedicated fan base. And I think that the equivalent to something you're talking about, Adam, would be if she did not like the direction that her Netflix, the Netflix adaptation of her show was going in, she could make a stink online and it could be.
And, I interviewed her for the first season and the showrunner, and they made a lot of very radical structural changes to that adaptation. And it's also not to get too granular on something that's nothing to do with this movie, but they very smartly kind of brought her into the fold and made her part of that process to sort of mitigate that issue.
Yeah, it is interesting because, one of the many things that I love about this miniseries that we're doing on 92 is I keep trying to put my brain into a 1992 headspace. And it is fascinating to think about the power that was wielded in different ways, because quite frankly, technology, the internet didn't exist. And they're just you were really at the behest of magazine articles and, reading the trades and reading these kind of things that obviously now don't have nearly the power because truth is not a thing anymore, apparently. But this is all just to say, I do think that this movie, one of the big things that they changed about this book is something I'm teeing you up here, Adam, for I think your Royals rant, which is that in the novel, the assassination attempt was made on the Prince of Wales and the many members of the British royal family, and they appeared in the book. They were replaced by fictitious characters in the screenplay. Prince Charles was replaced by Lord Holmes, a non-existent cousin of Queen Elizabeth, the Queen Mother. Do you have thoughts on this, Adam?
Well, the incident itself feels like it's inspired by two events that really happened in the 1970s. One is the assassination of Lord Mountbatten, in which his yacht was blown up with him and a lot of his family on it. And the other was the attempted kidnapping of Princess Anne.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
My rant is that anybody who's watched The Crown knows that that show did recreate the assassination of Lord Mountbatten. But for reasons that remain utterly inexplicable to me, they did not include the attempted kidnapping of Princess Anne, in which when the guy got in the car and said, get out, Princess Anne said, reportedly, not bloody likely or something to that effect, and basically like was in a standoff with him. I read, anybody who's a fan of The Crown, you read ahead on Wikipedia or whatever to sort of learn what's happening. And when I came across that story, I was like, I cannot wait.
Yeah, I can't believe they did
to see this. The actress they had playing that role is wonderful. Incredible. Was wonderful for seasons 3 and 4, which is when it would have fallen into. And they didn't do it. I don't understand why. I will never be over it, I think, in a small way. It's just, it's inexplicable.
And it is bizarre.
Watching this movie, I again was reminded that The Crown didn't do it.
Yeah, I don't fully, listen, I understand them creating these fictionalized characters. I think it was obviously for the best. I think that they, felt in this adaptation. I can't speak to The Crown, obviously. I don't know. But I also just
Can't you though? You're Canadian. You have the Queen on your money.
That's the only allegiance we have to her, though, it seems. But
do you have the king on your money now?
We will soon have the king on our money.
Wow.
Why do you have to Canada's do that? Canada's not excited about it.
Listen, we just put old racists on our money. Why do you have to have the king on your money?
Listen, it's a whole thing. I guess my question to you guys, because I am not particularly well versed in IRA, you know, history and the Irish sort of their issues with the Brits and all of that. This movie goes out of its way to create a faction, a sort of terrorist faction outside of the IRA, to sort of be this, you know, off the books, they're so crazy, the IRA doesn't want anything to do with them type thing. Is that a thing? Does that exist? I'm assuming it does.
I don't know. Okay. I mean, like, the troubles were resolved pretty soon after this movie came out, weirdly enough.
Oh, that's true.
And
true.
So
I know this from watching Dairy Girls.
And so I don't know. I mean, it's interesting to me that this movie pretends like the assassination on Lord Mountbatten didn't happen.
Yes, correct.
Because that, you know, it was like at the very end of the 70s when that assassination happened. That I do know. I also, you know, what I think the movie does effectively, mm-hmm. in a general sense, if not in a sense of like, I have no idea how realistic it was or not to the particulars of the Troubles and how the IRA and Sinn Féin operated. Mm-hmm. But this is also sort of an interesting thing about the transmutation of adapting a guy who's like an ultra right wing asshole into a feature film that has to be like accessible to everybody. Mm-hmm. It sort of almost upends this. Reviews I read of Patriot Games said that Northern Ireland terrorists come off as like total caricatures, like that Clancy has zero empathy for them, and so they come off as like creatures, not really even like mm-hmm. human. And the movie, I think, does a really good job of getting under the skin of what's driving their actions. It like, there was early on, I was weirdly reminded of the series Andor, because mm-hmm. Andor sort of takes the sort of revolutionary's perspective, and like the scene where Polly Walker walks into the Rare bookstore and has the coded conversation is very similar to scenes that are like that in Andor. And so it's like, it was sort of jarring to be like, well, in that show, I'm in on the revolutionary side. In this show, these are bad guys. What?
Right.
P.S. I had no idea that was Polly Walker until I end credits. And I was like, what?
It's pretty crazy.
About an interesting career. But I do think that the movie does a really thoughtful job of explicating what's driving their extremism, yes. in shorthand. Like, it's very, it does not get into the nitty gritty of it at all, let alone the sort of the history of it.
Mm-hmm.
You have an appreciation for where they're coming from in a way that I gather the book just never did.
Yeah. Emily?
I do think, like, everything you're saying is true. And especially compared to a book I've never read, which, knowing Tom Clancy, I imagine was as bad as everybody said it was. I also just want to note that Richard Harris plays a man named Patty O'Neill, who is, you know, has a very thick accent.
He does.
And like, I don't think he's playing a caricature at all. Like, he's playing a real character, but there is an element of it where he does kind of feel it does kind of feel like this movie is constantly on the verge of turning into like a stereotype fest in a weird way.
Yeah.
Even though it never quite does. I think a lot of that is just Sean Bean has like a natural gravitas to him. But yeah, every time Richard Harris is on screen, I'm terrified that it's just going to like turn into a bad accent fest.
Well, he's got this hair thing going on. Yeah. Richard Harris does, where he looks like a leprechaun. Like he looks like leprechaun hair.
He looks like Darby O'Gill from Darby yes. O'Gill and the Little People.
Exactly. Yeah.
So I'm curious if you to hear your thoughts on this, Adam, because this has to do with Variety. I don't know if you know this story. Do you know this sport I'm about to?
I know.
Okay. So Paramount yanked all their advertising out of Variety when one of the magazine's film critics, Joseph McBride, called the film, quote unquote, fascistic, blatantly anti-Irish, a right-wing cartoon. So Variety's editor at the time, Peter Bart, privately sided with Paramount's boycott, calling McBride unprofessional. Bart was then subsequently embarrassed when his letter criticizing one of his reviewers and supporting studio censorship was leaked to the press. Then the Los Angeles Film Critics Association, National Society of Film Critics, publicly lambasted Bart for his dismaying treatment of one of its members of the staff, saying the question is not whether any responsible critic is right or wrong, but whether any responsible critic must be muted so as to not offend an advertiser or bruise a handful of tender egos. An interesting little tussle in the early 90s. Do you have thoughts on it? Without upsetting your like, current employer?
I need a moment. I think what I would say is, first of all,
I don't mean to put you on the least spot, surprising Adam,
thing that Peter, like, it's the least surprising thing to learn about Peter Bart that he would do that. like, the least. I wish I could say that I think that this is a not just a trade issue, but I think that like there's always been a tension between at every place I've worked between a critic's whenever a critic is particularly vicious to a movie and not even the other side of the like not even the church and state separation, but like the edit like there's the critical side and then there's the editorial side of a publication.
Sure.
And often you find yourself writing about a movie and trying to talk to people who made the movie almost on top of when a critic has just roasted it, and that can get dicey. So I have a lot of empathy for everybody at Variety in 1992 when that was all going down. I also like would just note that like John McTiernan, who directed The Hunt for Red October, could have directed this movie and declined because of his Irish heritage, it made him uncomfortable. He wanted to do Clear and Present Danger instead.
Yes.
And
then Philip Noyce was brought in I think that what I like about this story, you know, how much truth, who knows what happened exactly, obviously, but the leaking of the letter is crazy to think about. Like to think that like someone leaked this internal letter that Peter Bart had, like it all just feels so like oddly I don't know. It's you don't get stuff like this anymore because everyone is obviously so there's so much synergistic what have you, and everyone is kind of talking to everybody and tweets and this that, and like it all just kind of feels as though there's very little kind of stuff that's kept under people's. Well,
I would say not to make a wild extrapolation, but
sure,
exactly do that. I would say that it sort of is representative of one of the reasons why studios don't make movies like this anymore, because every time a lot of the times that a studio wades into current geopolitics, somebody's going to get mad. And, you know, it's interesting that, in all of the things that I read about Clear and Present Danger, there was no constituency for, people from Colombia protesting about the representation of Colombian drug cartels. yeah. in the way that there might have been, there was a constituency represent like angry about the representation of people from Northern Ireland. So, you know, it's perhaps why whenever studios have leaned into geopolitics, they tend to go into directions where the bad guys have no political constituency. And that's becoming harder and harder to accomplish. So it's becoming harder and harder to make a movie about something happening now where you're not pissing somebody off. And people are just so averse to like no studio wants, like studios don't want to piss off anybody now.
Well, look at Top Gun Maverick. I mean,
yeah.
That's it. Hey, that is a cutting edge geopolitical thriller about our fight.
I love Top Gun Maverick, but like, I don't know who they're fighting.
Yeah, no, I was thinking
they're fighting the asshole architect who created a bunker inside the most ridiculously designed cave mountain situation.
Perfect. That's no notes.
I just realized this. Top Gun Maverick and Tenet, the Christopher Nolan movie, kind of have the same plot. Like, not. I mean, obviously, one has time travel and one has planes, but like, you know, you get into the bunker with time travel, or you get into it with planes. Yeah. Either way.
Yeah. There's a couple other things that I just wanted to mention that I think are interesting. There's a line in the trailer for Patriot Games where someone says, "There's never been a terrorist attack on American soil." That was removed from the theatrical release because it sounded too much like an invitation or a dare.
Well,
and then the World Trade Center first bombing was 93.
Yep.
Yeah.
Oh yeah. And Oklahoma City's 95. So yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Thanks, also, Paramount.
Well, I doubt the trailer for Patriot Games was what these people needed as an invitation, but
and yet here we sit.
What if that's what just like really stuck in one of their craws?
Set them over the edge. At the end of this film, and we will talk about the ending, Emily, when we get to it. But I do think that apparently Dr. Zalian is a tribute to Steven Zalian, who did an uncredited rewrite on this film, for what that's worth. So I kind of want to just, we'll jump around a little bit because like really ultimately there's not, we've hit on some of the plot of this film, but ultimately, you know, the movie opens with this. Yes, Emily, sorry, you look like
I want to be clear. We have been discussing this movie and I keep taking us on tangents because that's what I do on this show. But like, I watched this movie. I enjoyed this movie. We keep discussing it. I keep being like, I like that scene. I don't remember this movie at all. Like, you'll mention the thing and I'll be like, I remember that happening. But it's just like, it kind of just like rolled right off of me.
Right off of me too. And I was surprised at how, so we talked about this a little bit, Adam and I, before we got on mic, but like this movie feels very emblematic of sort of lo-fi action thrillers of the kind of late 80s, early 90s.
Yeah,
the moment in 90s.
I thought we talked about that on mic.
Were we on mic? Like maybe we were on mic. Maybe it was the first thing we talked about. My apologies.
I describe it as peak your parents going to the movies cinema. Yes. Like this is a movie that your parents go to and you go to bed and you wake up the next morning and your mom summarizes it to you and you're like, what's the IRA? And she's like, oh, well.
I physically remember so many kind of like fragments of this film back when I was a kid. I remembered the sort of that first, the attempt on the lives of these British members. I think it's a great sequence. What I like about this movie is that there are set pieces, but they don't feel like set pieces because they're dialed down because we were making movies in 92. So it all kind of feels very grounded, but it also kind of makes it flattens it out a little bit, if that makes sense. So it all kind of feels homogenous.
See, that's the thing that I love.
Right.
When I said earlier that I felt like this was sort of a perfect encapsulation of what it wanted to do, part of it is that it goes down easy. It comes out easy. I just when I started the metaphor, I had to finish the metaphor.
You had to finish it.
And I apologize to everyone. I'm sorry to everyone.
No, it's great. I understood and I appreciate it.
Yeah, I appreciate it.
But it like it, the fact that it rolls off of you is sort of like part of the appeal to me. Like, not every entertainment you watch has to like sit with you, but it has to be engaging and you have to sort of be invested in it. And I was engaged and I was invested, and then it was over and I was like, okay, I'm going to go.
There is something very, and I know that this is a word that has sort of a negative connotation, but there is something very simple or simplistic about this movie in the sense that it's very clean, right? You've got a guy, he stops an assassination attempt in the process, bad guy's brother is killed, bad guy wants to get revenge. Like, that is ultimately the movie. And everything else also, is just kind of jazz hands.
It's also a bit of a process movie.
Okay.
In that it keeps, it shows you the Hollywood version of how they do all of, like how the CIA operates, how the IRA operates, and in ways that you're sort of like, you feel like you're learning things, whether you actually are or not. You feel like, oh, that's interesting. I didn't know that's how they did that. And get, like, this is, they tried to recreate this sequence in Clear and Present Danger, and it didn't work as well for me. And it was even the same James Horner music, I think, which also, P.S., this is also part of why it's like a peak 92 movie, is it has like the like perfect this kind of movie James Horner score. The whole sequence where Harrison Ford is trying to like they have all of these different disparate pieces as they're trying to find Sean Miller, but they can't quite put it together. And this is where the sort of like analyst nerd stuff kicks in, where he's like just sort of like thinking, and he gets up and he goes to splash water on his face, and he ends up, he's actually in the women's bathroom, and
which is so unnecessary. You could have had him see her hair outside
in a different context, but I don't know. So, you know, like the ponytail whip, and it's like they even call out how absurd the like logic leaps he's making are.
Sure.
But I just love that shit. It's
like, amazing how much of this movie hinges on Polly Walker's wig. Like, it is, it's crazy to me. First of all, why she's wearing a wig most of the time is
anytime she's
out
in public. Anytime she's out in public, she's wearing a wig so that when she's, so they can't connect her to being the IRA. I think.
Which is, just think about what you just said out loud.
Hey, I'm not saying it makes sense. I'm just saying that's what it is.
No, I know. I just, to me, it's like I was watching this movie. You've got Polly Walker at one point seducing this guy and killing him, and she takes off her wig. And I was like, why did we need the wig? And then like the wig is a major part of this plot. Like, this entire movie hinges on it. Yeah. It's crazy. I mean, it's great. I'm not complaining. But it is a good wig.
In the history of Hollywood wigs, it is on the top half of them.
Sure.
There've been a lot of bad Hollywood wigs, is what I'm saying.
This movie has a deep bench of character actors.
Yes.
From the 90s. James Earl Jones, Sean Bean, Sam Jackson, right before Jurassic Park, right? I mean, we're on the cusp of Sam Jackson becoming Samuel L. Jackson. A thankless role in this movie, basically doesn't really get to do very much or make much of an impression.
He's the friend. He's the buddy.
Yeah, he's fine.
He's the buddy who has the one jokey moment.
Yes.
And then it's like the he serves a sort of action function in the final act.
Yes.
Like it's the part that Samuel L. Jackson had been playing different versions of for
years.
Yes.
Emily, I don't know if you know this, but we actually damn it. We're doing back-to-back Ted Raimi movies. Ted Raimi opens Candyman. He is the guy in the beginning of Candyman. And he's a CIA technician in this film.
He barely has any lines, but he's like there.
He is there. This it's around this time as Jack Ryan is trying to piece together Polly Walker's identity that we have arguably one of the best lines in the film that Emily texted me. Do you want to talk about this?
I this is why I have the Harrison Ford impression. Just so to Harrison Ford is like looking at a screen. It's like looking at a thing, at a photo or something. And he just leans forward and looks right in the camera and he goes, "Tits." He just says the word tits. And you're like,
it is so ridiculous. It is so this is the thing about Jack Ryan as a character, as a universe, whatever. There is no joy. It's so joylessness. There's no fun in these movies because they take themselves so goddamn seriously that you've got like Jack Ryan grumbling tits, and it's not even like meant to be funny. It's meant to be like serious. I just don't understand what's going on.
It's the Jack Ryan Jack Ryan's whole deal has the air of like your dad has a friend who works at Langley who got you a tour, and you'd better not crack jokes, mister. It's just that.
It's crazy. You also have a line that is so painfully earnest, which I don't know if you guys remember.
Is it also tits?
It's not. It is James Earl Jones. They're in like a conference room and they're talking about whether or not they should go on this mission, essentially. And Jack Ryan says something along the lines of like, you know, someone asks him if he's 100% certain. And James Earl Jones says, "Jack, tell me something that's 100% certain." And Jack says, "My daughter's love."
Now, before I was a parent, that line is just the corniest thing you've ever heard. As a parent,
still the corniest thing you've ever heard.
I don't care. It got me. I cried. Oh, I got a little teary. I know it's corny.
It is a fucking curse. You have a kid, yep, and suddenly someone in a movie will be like the worst movie you've ever seen.
Yes.
It'll be like a movie about like Vladimir Putin, and he'll be like, "Well, yes, but I love my child. Who can't relate to the love of a tiny baby?" And I'll be like, "I can relate to, I have a tiny baby, Vlad. I do."
Yeah, it's true. It's like, it really, It is a curse because like you just don't have any control anymore over like totally. And that's the one time in the movie where it feels like Harrison Ford is playing an idea instead of a guy.
Absolutely.
But I also wanted to just shout out really quickly. There's a lot of great character actors in this. The one that I was most excited about, was Ellen Gear.
Okay.
Oh, yeah.
Who plays, like, you have no Ellen idea what Gear. I'm talking about.
I'm looking up Ellen Gear right now, okay.
She plays Rose, who is the sort of older woman
who welcomes him
back. She's great. To the
fold. Yeah.
He's great. She, this is a Star Trek nerd alert.
Oh, great, okay.
She has a standout episode of Star Trek The Next Generation, it's the episode Silicon Avatar. It's about the crystalline entity. If you know what I'm talking about, you know what I'm talking about. I'm not going to bother going into it because we've already gone on too many tangents. But it's like a guest star. She's the main person episode. She's incredible in it. And when I think I saw this movie, if I didn't see it in the theater, I saw it like maybe my parents rented it and they let me watch it with them. That sounds more likely what happened, because I think I saw it young, and when she came on screen, all of a sudden I got a lot more interested. it was the actor from the episode of Star Trek: The Next Generation that I loved so much. So that has always stayed in my head.
I did not see this until yesterday, but I can imagine that happening to me when Broadway legend Bob Gunton shows up for like two lines. And I would have just turned to someone I was with and been like, "He's from the original cast of Evita," and they would have been like, "Yes, of course, Bob Gunton."
So, as we mentioned, you know, this movie has a relatively simple story, which is that Sean Bean's character essentially wants revenge, and will stop at nothing to get it. Goes all the way to the United States in order to find Jack Ryan and his family. Goes as far as to pull out an Uzi on a highway to try to shoot Ann Archer and their child. A great sequence. Like, again, great car chase. You've got to love stuff that just feels so tactile. Like, we just don't we don't get that stuff anymore. And Archer.
I love the part where Harrison Ford's trying to call her and yes. she's on hold.
Yes.
And then he calls. This is also one of those things where it's like, is this a thing? Could you?
Yes. I know what you're about to say.
Where he calls the operator. He's like, I'd like to make an emergency breakthrough. Now, first of all, is that a thing? Could one have ever done that? But second, when he's like, yes, it's a mobile phone. What do you mean I can't? Like, it was like just those three ideas in rapid succession.
It was so crazy. Like,
it certainly ratchets up the tension of he's got to get to her. He's trying to reach her. She can't, like, and she's still on hold. And it's like, why can't she get off the phone? And like, we need an extra beat because it's not just that he can't reach her. He's got to try something else. What can he do? I don't know. Let's pretend there's such a thing as an emergency breakthrough. I don't know. I just love
it. I thought the exact same thing. I was like, was that ever a thing? Like, is there the possibility of doing that?
Every time I go to my therapist's office and I'm in crisis, I say I need an emergency breakthrough. So I assume that's actually you can't like you were able to do that. Like, I grew up in a small enough rural area where like that was a thing. And you'd have to be like with the authorities, but you could basically just like the phone operator would just patch you in over the call.
That's incredible.
Like, I just imagine.
That's mind-blowing, quite honestly.
If I had that power, I would abuse it all the time. If I was president, that's all I would do. I would just. Us break into people's phone calls. That's why I'm not pressed.
It's a great scene, but I want to just take a second to talk about Ann Archer, who I feel is always just Ann Archer, like is always this role. Am I crazy when I say that? Because I feel like, I mean, Fatal Attraction, that she just feels like she's the wife. She's like a good wife.
And not just the wife, but like, what the one beat that I will say felt the least real to me and the most 92 in this in a weird way mm-hmm. is after the opening action sequence where he's rushed in and he's been shot
yeah.
and then she comes in, she's like, I'm a doctor, that's my husband, I'm gonna treat him yeah. and they're in the hospital. She, any spouse would have read him the riot act for doing that. Like, how dare you?
Yeah.
With our daughter yeah. just yeah. there. Don't ever do that again. Like, something along those lines. And she's like, I understand.
She's very understanding.
I understand. Like, and yeah. like in the sequence earlier where he forgets to get like champagne mm-hmm. to like, I think it's even their anniversary, maybe.
Yes, it is.
And he forgets to do any of that. She orders the champagne and he's like, I'm sorry, I didn't do it. And she's like, it's okay. Well, just one of us had to. Like, it's like the most it's like understanding, like totally doesn't get mad about anything.
Just like Emily.
Yeah.
When I got together with Jack Ryan on Tinder or whatever I did that on, and he was like, I have the two things. And one of them was Settlers of Catan night. I leave him that. And the other was Saving the World. And I was like, whatever you need to do, you save that world.
It's a crazy thing. And I do feel a little bad because Ann Archer, you know, she's a fine actress. I don't really have a problem with her, but I do feel like she just is continually emotional wallpaper to these like overtly sort of strong men.
Great 90s hair in this. Great 90s amazing hair. 90s hair.
This all kind of leads up to essentially like the last half an hour of this movie is at their house. And it's basically just they're having this dinner and then the bad guys show up and they turn off all the power in their house. And it's like, yeah, sorry.
Oh, so this is the other thing about the original book that I have to talk about. Okay. Because it is crazy. Crazy. So in the original book,
yeah,
both the attack the first attack where they cause the wife's car to crash mm-hmm. and this attack at their house. Mm-hmm. It's in the book. It's not just the IRA. Sean Miller recruits the assistance of an African-American domestic terrorist group known as the Movement. So in both of these sequences, it's not just the IRA. It's these like completely made up radical black terrorists helping them out. Like,
that doesn't sound great.
Talk about, like, I cannot, if that book came out like even 5 years later, let alone now, it would have just been destroyed. Just, it's like such an 80s artifact.
It's insane.
Such a Reagan era artifact, that idea. I just, it, like, when I saw that, I was like, you've got to be kidding me. I mean,
if any of our listeners need to sort of really get a sense of Tom Clancy, just look up a picture of him. Just Google him, because he's definitely wearing, I mean, Tom Clancy would have been MAGA, let's just put it that way. But I do think that, so this movie had a different ending, which was far less action-packed, let's just say. It ultimately ended with, like, basically a fist fight on the shoreline between Sean and Jack Ryan. And the test audiences didn't love it. So they ponied up, like, got to be a couple million dollars to do this, quite frankly, amazing boat chase action sequence that I think is phenomenal to watch. I mean, and the way it's shot is just amazing. You are truly, yeah, like, how did they get this footage? It looks amazing. They do a great job. A great sort of fight scene that sort of evolves, despite the fact that Ebert didn't like it. I thought it was pretty great. Obviously, Sean Miller dies. His boat explodes when he's stabbed by some weird pointy object that he sort of, you know, throws himself on. Oh, is that an anchor?
That's the anchor.
That makes sense. Okay.
I like how you sound like you're trying to like plumb the lore here, just being, and it's part of like the Ryanverse lore, which I don't know very well.
But all this being said, big action sequence, blah, blah, blah. Sean Miller dies. Jack Ryan lives, yada, yada, yada. But the movie ends on
the best scene.
So Emily texts me after she finishes the film and she's like, best scene in the movie. And I was like, but it's from a different movie. It doesn't feel like it's from this movie. I'm going to let Emily explain what happens at the end of this film.
So throughout the film, the film opens with I've already forgotten it. Ann Archer.
Yeah.
Telling her husband, Jack Ryan, I'm pregnant. It's exciting.
No, first it opens with the conception.
Oh, the conception. That's right. That's right.
They bone.
Yeah.
And then we're led to believe certain period of time
this
later.
Is true. This that is true.
Boning,
okay. Yes.
Was
I forgot. It's very hard for me to see my husband with his first wife, but I accept it.
So she tells him she's pregnant.
Yeah, and they already have Thora Birch as their child. We haven't really talked
precocious
about her.
Precocious Thora
she's
Birch.
She's giving a very good child performance, whatever.
Yeah, she's great, yeah.
And so throughout the film, it's like, oh, are we going to have a girl or a boy? And Thora Birch is like, I want a sister, or I don't want a brother, blah, blah, blah. All that stuff. It's like a little runner. The last scene of the film, Ann Archer's on the phone with the doctor. She's like, hey, do you want to know the sex of the child? And
she asks Harrison and Thora.
She asks Harrison Ford that. And then he's like, hey, Thora Birch, what do you think about this? And they like do this. And they like they go back and forth. They kind of exchange glances. And Archer's like, I'm on the phone. He's waiting. And finally, Thora Birch like nods a little. And then Harrison Ford nods a little. And then Ann Archer's like, okay, we'd like to know. And then the film ends. And so, of course, I immediately started, it's such a good cliffhanger. I immediately started watching Clear and Present. Clear and Present Danger. I spoiled myself. They have a boy named Jack Ryan Jr.
Yeah.
And that boy grew up to be John Krasinski.
So, it's a cute scene. Don't get me wrong. And I found myself, for reasons that I can't even believe I'm saying this out loud, was genuinely curious as to the gender of their child. Like, I was like, I wonder if they're having a boy or a girl. And then they rob me of that. It literally smashes to black. She's like, thank you. Hangs up the phone, looks at them kind of, you know, mischievously, and then just credits roll. And I was just like, are you fucking kidding me? This is how you ended this movie?
Philip Noyce wanted us to consider that gender is a myth. Go ahead.
That's true.
Well, I Thank you. I I was not going to say anything quite as profound. What I was going to say is, to me, it was the one moment of agency that Ann Archer's character was afforded.
True.
Yeah.
She's with the whole
thing. She got to decide whether we all learned
what that baby, that's great.
You know, a sex assigned at birth was going to be.
Yes. I do think this is indicative of the ways in which movie franchises have changed. Because at this point in time, like Jack Ryan, every movie, he's going to have a new adventure. There's not like accumulating lore, because the lore is just like, Ireland exists. And you're like, yes, I know, of course. but like, so you don't have this like rich, like rogues gallery or whatever. So all of the serialization is in his personal life. So his wife and his kids have to be like important characters to some degree. So a thing like this is the sort of thing that like is the juice that gets you to the next movie. It's why the cliffhanger works, even though it seems like it's from a different movie entirely. Whereas like, now you kind of can't do that. You know, like you couldn't end Captain America New World Order with like a character waiting to find out the sex assigned at birth of their child. Like you just, it's just not going to, because movies don't work in the same way now. There's just so much you have to keep on top of. Whereas, and I think that's part of why Jack Ryan has not translated very well to the 21st century, because the second you're like trying to give him like a whole bunch of serialized whatever, it just, it doesn't work because he's so wedded to a particular geopolitical time and place.
Do you think though?
Yes.
That like, if one of the Twilight movies, the Twilight kind of pulled this shit though. Like I know what you're saying and I don't necessarily disagree with you, but like Twilight literally, like the second one ends with her being like, maybe I'll marry him. Like it's kind of doing stuff like that.
Phil. Are you trying to compare
adaptation
of a Tom Clancy novel with an adaptation of a book series about werewolves and vampires?
I mean, yeah. I just, I guess I'm speaking more to the idea that I don't necessarily disagree with Emily's hypothesis. I think she's right. But I guess my point is more that these type of little character nuggets, these soapy things, still kind of exist in franchises. That's all.
I think it, I mean, we're talking about YA, where one of the buy-ins is often which boy is she going to kiss? You know,
sure.
Like that is even a more plot heavy franchise like Hunger Games has that element. And like, granted, they don't build the cliffhangers off of that in that franchise. But like, so I do think it's inherent to the genre there in a way it isn't with Tom Clancy.
Yeah.
Also, I thought you were talking about Renée Esmée, Bella and Edward's child from Twilight Breaking Dawn Part 2.
I don't think it's Renée Esmée, right?
Renée Esmée. Okay. All right. It's been a while since, you know, I did my annual Twilight rewatch. But I thought you were just talking about what if a Tom Clancy novel had the child of two vampires who ages unnaturally fast, and she's just like in a book about like, you know, like the rebels, the Chechen rebels or something.
I'd read that. So I want to rate this film because I'm curious, Adam, if you've seen the film that we're talking about next week, and if you have thoughts on it. I saw this film in 92, as I mentioned. In 92 at 12, I think I probably would have given this film a 60. I think I was pretty bored. Didn't really understand what was going on. Watching this the other day, it went up in my esteem. I put it at like a 72. I'm going to hold it like a 74. I feel like I like this film fine. I don't imagine I'll ever watch it again. And in the sort of Harrison Ford oeuvre, it's in the middle. Like, I don't.
And this is up to
99, 0 to 99.
99, okay.
Yeah.
So not 92.
Not 92. I feel like that'd be confusing.
The title of our show is a lie, is just to be clear.
Anyway. So Adam, where do you fall on this film?
I think, I don't think my opinion has changed on it. I think it's stayed pretty consistent, and I would put it like an 80.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah. I think like no higher though. Like, I think it's like, you know, it is in what I was saying earlier about how it's like the perfect example of a very specific kind of solid entertainment, mm-hmm. That delivers exactly what it wants to and gives you the experience you want in the theater and then mm-hmm. dissipates from your brain.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Very soon after, but you don't feel like you were consuming empty calories as you were watching it. I think that gets to an 80 for me. And I think, I don't know what the kid version of me would have necessarily said. I remember being interested in it though. I'd have to ask my parents though, if I was bored, but like the times that I've revisited it since. Now I will say,
yes,
I think The Hunt for Red October is a much better movie.
Oh yeah.
And I think that movie has stayed with me. I think it's about more than just giving you a good time. And like, so to compare that, like that's like an 89-90 movie for me. Like that's like, you cannot get much better than that kind of, like as an example. And that is like also the daddiest dad movie. Like, my father is obsessed with submarines.
Oh, okay.
Like as a kid and to this day. So he was like super, I saw that with my dad and with my grandfather. At the same, like we went to the theater to see it. I remember doing that very much. So maybe I did see Patriot Games in the theater. I'm just.
I like that we're going on this journey.
I'm spooling my memory now. I just in real time to you both.
Perfect.
But
so you're at an 80. That's where
I'm at an 80, and okay. Like okay. It's a point of comparison. Like Hunt for Red October is like an 89, and Clear and Present Danger is like a 60.
Oh wow. Okay.
Yeah.
Emily, where are you on Patriot Games?
I love Hunt for Red October. I'm mm-hmm. just going to concur there. I'm going to start with the 90s queer phobia scale, which mm-hmm. is just ranking movies from the 90s in 1992 in terms mm-hmm. of how queer phobic they are, 10 being the most and 0 being the least. I'm going to give this movie a 4. There's no like real overt queer phobia, but you can just sort of tell that this is a world where queer people don't exist at all. And that's.
Oh, no, I would disagree with you.
Okay.
I think the officious assistant, who's the turncoat of the, and the right. book and the rare bookstore owner
yes.
were ex-lovers.
Okay.
Ed Cannon and I did in my head watching it the most recent
Are
time.
Are you writing fanfic? Patriot's fanfic?
And honestly, Emily, this is your influence. I think I rewatched it yesterday being like, if I was Emily, how would I interpret this situation? I think honestly that's what I did. And that's only from listening to you on podcasts, frankly. But like because we've just met on this particular episode, even though I've read you for forever. Anyway, the headcanon I did was that the reason that there was a connection between the rare bookstore owner
uh-huh.
and this assistant, who, you know, there's the old axiom, is he British or is he gay? I think that they were both. I think they were ex-lovers. So I think they're lovers now. And I think their relationship was somehow leveraged against both of them to help the IRA. That was the headcanon I did.
I like it.
To make the connection make sense. Because it's never really explained how this assistant is connected to this whole larger web. And so that was the work I did in my own head.
Does that affect your queer phobia?
I got to knock it back to a 3 because this is a rich and nuanced portrayal of the ways that queer relationships struggled to gain like notice Fraction. From the public
yeah.
at large.
Yeah.
And then also like when they were over, you know, how could you mark them? Well, you could get blackmailed by an intelligence agency or a terrorist organization rather, into supporting the IRA. So like,
yeah,
this is really a progressive take.
That's interesting.
I think it's what I'm saying.
How does the film rank otherwise for you?
Well, here's the problem is, again, I don't remember this movie at all. We have talked about this movie and we just talked about the yeah. two characters
yes.
who were in the movie and I've already forgotten who they were. No, I put this just below single white female on my rankings on Letterboxd, which everyone can go look at. Mm-hmm. And I gave single white female famously and honestly a 69. And I came to that number honestly. And then when I said it, I was like, I see what I did there. So I think I have to go 68. I had a good time watching this movie. It's just too straight to be a 69, you know? It just is.
So I'm next week we're covering have you seen the film Stay Tuned, Adam? Is that a movie that you know or
heard of? Is that the one with
Yes, it is. It is the movie with Jason Ritter.
Yeah.
John Ritter, my apologies. Pam Dauber, Jeffrey Jones.
And they're stuck in
Eugene Levy.
Right?
Yeah. Basically, it's about a suburban couple who are sucked into a television world by an emissary of hell, and they must survive for 24 hours in order to be released from it. I've never seen it. I remember this movie because I remember seeing a trailer and actually it upsetting me pretty deeply when I was 12 and just feeling like I wasn't sure how to process this. We have Louis Peitzman coming on to talk about it with us.
Louis.
Wow.
My apologies.
When there was a time when he was touchy about that.
Okay. Well, I appreciate that, and you that's pointing his it issue. Out. Then. Yeah.
I feel like if you have a name that it could be pronounced as Louis or Lewis, you have to live with people.
Yes. Lewis Peitzman is coming on the podcast to talk about this. This was a film that he picked. It was at the top of his list of films that he wanted to talk about from 1992. I think this was a real movie for him as a child. Emily, have you seen Stay Tuned?
First of all, I want to tell you, you can always call me MLY. I have not seen this movie. I really wanted to see it. This is one of the movies, and it came and went from theaters. It was a huge flop. The reason I really wanted to see is I liked the idea of getting sucked into a television, and I was a huge Pam Dauber stan. So, like, that we're going to unpack all that.
I will say, first of all, I have not seen this movie.
Mm-hmm.
Second of all, this movie had passed me by without my realizing it existed.
Sure.
And then a couple years ago with Mark Harris... The first time I convinced Mark Harris to do screen drafts was doing an episode where it was movies about television. And this was on the sort of long list of movies to look at. And I just didn't get to it.
did it make an appearance on the draft?
No, it did not. Neither of us drafted. Like, Mark didn't even bring it up. And I think I remember looking up at the time whether I could stream it or if I had to rent it. And I think at the time you couldn't stream it. I just now saw that it's currently on Amazon Prime.
It is.
Like, congratulations to that movie. But I, at the time, and so because I couldn't stream it and there's a bunch of other movies on my list I had to get to, I just didn't see it. So
it is. Yes, go ahead, Emily. Sorry.
I when you told me we were doing it, Phil, I did just cursory research and discovered there is an original soundtrack, which has its own Wikipedia page and is available on Spotify. I listened to the soundtrack. I still haven't watched the movie, but I listened to the Stay Tuned soundtrack. So
there is the poster for this movie is I remember it vividly because it scared me. The poster is essentially John Ritter and Pam Dauber shackled to chairs with a sort of Wheel of Fortune thing behind them, trapped, imprisoned inside a television set while their children and their dog are looking on. So I'm ready. I'm excited, quite honestly.
I love when you pitched this show to me and when you were like, hey, what 1992 movies do you want to do? I said one movie, and it's like genuinely one of the most unsettling films ever made. I'm not going to say what it is. Eventually we're going to talk about it.
We are.
And I'll reveal what that is. One of the most unsettling films ever made. And I was like, I got to do this one. And you were like, really, that one? And now you're revealing you were scared by the poster of Stay Tuned. So,
I mean, this is the thing that I think, Adam, I probably told this to you. I mean, I was a scaredy cat as a kid. I mean, I still am in a lot of ways. So, like, I was very impressionable, and I spent a lot of time in video stores. So as a kid, and I'm sure you guys had this too, right, where you'd be walking down the aisles, and those video box arts were very arresting, right? Like, that was the whole point, to get people to watch these movies. And whenever I was in the horror aisles, they're still burned in my brain, some of those box art. And Stay Tuned was just one of those that stayed with me. Candyman freaked me out. I didn't love it, but I lived through it. And, you know, we'll keep going.
What was the worst video case for you? And have you watched that film?
You know, I knew you were going to ask. I had a feeling you were going to ask me that. You know, the one that... Do you remember, or have you guys ever seen the movie Ghoulies? The Ghoulies art of him crawling out of the toilet.
Yeah.
The Ghoulie kind of pulling himself out of the toilet. Yeah, that one kind of stayed with me. I remember as a child thinking a lot about, is there a Ghoulie in my toilet?
That's going to be our Halloween special.
The one for me, this is a very basic bitch answer, but it was all the Hellraiser movies for me.
Sure.
Oh, yeah.
I was already a scaredy cat. There was no way that I was going to be a person who was going to get into horror, but that very much was like repelled me in how upsetting it was to look at. So
a lot of those, I mean, truthfully, Evil Dead 2, anything that had, I was just, I hated things turning into things. I hated ironically or not, I hated supernatural stuff. I didn't have a problem with like your Jasons and your, you know, your, Mike Myers, like all that stuff, because it was very kind of like, it was basic. It was a guy with a knife and whatever. It was the idea that like something could turn into something, or that some sort of a creature was going to come for, that shit just did not fly for me. With Stay Tuned, it was the idea of being trapped inside a television set seemed like a prison. But I've created my own prison for myself working in television.
Like, you just basically like laid out your entire professional origin story there.
Yeah, no? You mentioning you didn't like supernatural things just had me imagining your mom visiting the set for Sleepy Hollow, and as like the headless horseman gallops at camera, she says, "He has to control it."
Yeah. No, I mean, like, listen, it's
like Mitzi Fableman.
Yeah, my mother is a real Mitzi Fableman, let me tell you.
That was a bad Mitzi Fableman impression. I'm so sorry to Michelle Williams and Steven Spielberg's mom.
Adam, thank you so much for coming on and talking about Patriot Games with us.
Thank you so much for having me. This was an absolute delight.
We can't wait to have you back. I have your name next to a bunch of other movies, some of which I've never heard of, and I'm excited to talk about them.
Okay. Well, there's one that's much, 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 much gayer. So
I think that's the one I've never heard of.
Yeah.
Is Swoon? Is this the movie that you were referring to? Yes. Oh, so okay. I'm excited to talk about it. I can't wait. But you're the best. Where can people find you? They can find you on Twitter, right?
They can find me on Twitter for now, at Adam B. Vary. You can find me on Instagram at Adam B. Vary Plus, which I'm not particularly active there, but it exists because we're all just sort of waiting for the House of Cards that is Twitter to finally fully
crumble. Yeah.
Crumble in class.
And they can read your articles on
they
Variety.
Can read everything you can read of mine that's new is on variety.com.
Amazing. Do you have a new article that just came out or one that's coming out soon? Or
depends on when this goes live.
It'll be in May.
Well, I don't know.
My apologies.
Yeah.
Thank you so
probably
much.
Something having to do with Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 3, something
which I'm legitimately unreasonably excited for. So
I loved Volume 2. I loved it.
Adam, we can't wait to have you back, and thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you.
Bye, everybody.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. WarbyParker.com/covered.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to Amazon.com/comedy ad free. That's Amazon.com/comedy ad free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to Quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.